thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Every day.
Here's John Williams.
John, how are you? In the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. We're here until 3 o'clock. Then Ro and Anna come in. Until then, see what we can put together. I've got some thoughts, feelings, and recollections about Hugh Hefner and Playboy magazine when we recorded the Mincing Rascals podcast. I mentioned this to Steve Bertrand a little while ago. We all sort of recollected, what's your Playboy magazine story, boys? I don't know if women have a reaction to that, too, but men of a certain age, and I would say it's 100 down to something, 30, 20, 50, wherever the mark is, have a story of growing up around with or through that magazine, where you got caught or where you found some or where you have a Playboy magazine story. I'm going to ask you for that on Facebook and on our text line, and we'll give you a chance to call in on that as well. The Playboy magazine theme... Actually, no, the Playboy After Dark theme goes like this. Rick Hogan's in our studio. He wrote the story about Hugh Hefner's passing. You familiar with this song?
Oh, yeah.
I am not.
It's a lovely, listen to it.
It is nice.
It's a lovely theme song.
Back and watched a lot of the clips from the old Playboy After Dark show just as I was thinking about Hugh Hefner today. And it was really interesting because it was not great television and it wasn't as sexy as I thought it was going to be or as I remembered it.
Yeah.
But there was some pretty good music on that show.
Well, there were some pretty good guests there. I mean, at one point, one that I remember distinctly is it's the first time I ever saw Nina Simone perform. And I'm thinking... What is Nina Simone? This is when, in an age when African Americans were hardly ever on television at all.
The clip I watched was Sammy Davis Jr.
Yeah.
singing in the
yeah.
lounge there, and it was, or in the man, it wasn't the mansion, it was a TV set.
It was a TV set, yeah.
Made to look like some sort of swinging Playboy mansion, and it was good. It was really good.
Well, he knew how to spread that brand, man.
But you know,
he knew how to spread the brand.
Okay, so we'll just dive right into this. There was something also that, to me, was sort of incongruent about it. I mean, when you think of somebody who is promoting or selling sex, you might think of somebody who's more braggadocious or more coarse. But he was a little James Bond, suave and debonair, wasn't he?
Well, because I think sex was a part of it in the same way that sex was always, you may not realize it, not you, but people may not realize it as much. Sex was always part of the Bond movies, too. The names of the girls, the bathing suits, the dripping wet Ursula Andress. If that wasn't sex, I don't know what was. He was selling, I think, a lifestyle that included sex and beautiful women. I think that's the reason you felt that way about the show, John. It was everything. It was the coolest stereo. It was the coolest friends. It was the best wine. It was the finest clothes and the cutest girls.
So in the Tribune online right now, you wrote, you can read it. Was this in print today?
Yes,
or is this
it's in print tomorrow? Later print? Edition. No, it's in print today.
Yeah, and online as well. Some years ago, sitting in his castle-like mansion in Hombly Hills neighborhood of Los Angeles, Hugh Hefner was telling a visitor about the Halloween party taking place there in a few days. It would be, what, the 7,435th party of Hefner's exceptional, charmed, and successful life, a lavish bash for 1,000 or so of his closest and most comely friends. Now, this is a costume party, said Hefner. You will have to wear a costume. I was thinking, said the visitor, that with all due respect, I might get some pajamas, a robe, a pipe, slippers, and Pepsi, and going as, well, the young Hugh Hefner. The then 73-year-old Hefner laughed. He gave a sly smile and said, I'm sorry, that won't work. I'm going as the young Hugh Hefner.
That was me sitting with him. That was me in his house doing that.
Really?
And it was embarrassing. I mean, I thought, oh, what a cool idea. I'll go as the young Hugh Hefner.
You just called him an old man.
Yeah. The way he looked at me was like, I was an idiot. That was some party, man. The only people there, there were a number of topless young women who were dressed in some odd... I said, well, what is your costume exactly? Well, I'm a topless angel. Okay. There were like five of those. The only people not in costume at that party that I easily recognizable were Alan Thicke, Lou Ferrigno, and of all people, Cato Kaelin.
Why not?
Why not exactly? Everybody was saying, Jack Nicholson's here, Jack Nicholson's here. And people are like, where is he, where is he, where is he? And people are going, well, he's probably in costume. But it was one of the most lavish parties I have ever been to in my life.
So in your piece, you remind us his family's from Nebraska, but he was born in Chicago.
He was born in Chicago. He was born at Michael Reese Hospital. Yeah. Maybe the new setting for the, you know, for Amazon when it comes here. Raised on the Northwest Side in a pretty strict, very strict, actually, Methodist family. Went to public grammar school.
Ravenswood kid?
No, more like Galewood, West.
And so he's in high school putting out his own little publication,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. He had somehow, and you can't figure out how, some kind of artistic sensibility. He was always drawing comics. In grammar school, he published a paper of some sort, and that made a teacher go to his parents and said, look, if he continues this kind of behavior, he's going to wind up as a nothing. But he always did have that urge. He continued doing it in the 2.5 years. And you got to remember, he graduated University of Illinois, Champaign, in 2.5 years.
Yeah, why?
Because he was smart, and he was driven. Yeah. He was driven. I don't know if he knew what he was driven to.
Well, that's interesting, because I think the same person that says, I have this burning fire and I've got to do something with it. I'm going to not just go to U of I and have fun. I'm going to get through there in 2.5 years and leave a year and a half of fun on the table. To what end? But then he's got a job as an editor at a magazine.
Well, first, then he went in the service for a year.
Yeah, a lot of folks forget that.
And then he was like a copywriter for Esquire magazine. And in one of the biggest mistakes in the history of American publishing, Esquire is going to move from Chicago to New York. They're going to move their offices. And Hefner, I think, was making something like $60 a week. And he said, okay, I'll go if you give me a $5 raise. And they said no. They said no to
Why
Hugh
was
Hefner.
That a big mistake? Because he then goes
It was
off.
A big mistake for Esquire. It was a big mistake for Esquire. You got the young Hugh Hefner out there going, yeah, I have a new idea. What do you guys think of this? But I will maintain, John, that Hugh Hefner was indeed, for what he did, the right guy at the right time in the very sort of puritanical 50s, but also the right place. I do not believe that he would have been able to make a success of Playboy magazine had he been trying to do it in Manhattan, or certainly had he trying to been do it in, you know, Mobile, Alabama, or Omaha, Nebraska. I think the environment was right for him.
Why? How so?
Well, because I think there was a certain element of sophistication in Chicago just by dint of it being a big city. I also think that it inspired him when he got out of college in the service and he was married to Millie, who is still alive, by the way, his first wife. And they had little Christie in 1952, that he was able to wander the city and look at things that he aspired to. I mean, in Omaha, you would have walked around, I suppose, and looked at cattle farms and said, well, I don't want to be a cattle farmer. But he saw there was a level of sophistication that I think helped inspire what Playboy became.
Tell the story of his renting Marilyn Monroe's nude photo and how that launched his first edition.
Yeah, he wanted to feature naked women, which is highly unusual. And you're courting all sorts of problems with the law. But he would go to various art places that sold and rented photos, and he wound up being able to rent, not to own, a nude photo of Marilyn Monroe for $200.
Which is a lot of money, I presume, at the time.
I don't think it was that much money,
really,
even at the time.
Yeah.
Because Marilyn Monroe was a pretty considerable star.
Now that you mention it,
but this guy, whoever this guy was, owned the rights to the photo and said, sure, $200. He could not get... Something missing from my story, because the story is so long. He couldn't get a Chicago printer to print the magazine. He had to go get it printed in the suburbs.
Because they didn't want to touch the pornography?
Correct. What they thought was pornography. These were, I mean, I was born in 1953, but I was a little baby, so I don't know how pinched this place was. There were magazines you could buy, but nothing the mainstream.
So how does that first issue sell? You point
out
that he didn't put a date on it because You know, this wasn't volume one. He wasn't sure there was going to be volume
two.
No
question. It sold roughly 70,000 copies in 2 weeks.
A light bulb.
And he was on, his way. He initially wanted to call, not to get too deep in the, which is here, when he started, he was the only employee. He wanted to call the magazine Stag Party, you know, with a logo being a stag, a deer. And there were some copyright problems, and he couldn't do that. So he went to visit another, a man who was still alive, a designer, art director named Art Paul, who had a small office in the Loop. And he went down and told Art Paul what he was doing, and Art Paul was sort of intrigued. He, too, was a young, creative guy. And they said, well, we can't call it Stag. What do you, let's come up with another kind of animal. And so these two guys, who would love to hear this conversation, they were like, you know, don't, I guess it would be like this, don't bunnies like to have sex and stuff, Jeff? And they go, well, yeah, I guess. And, well, what about a bunny? And in less than 1 hour, Art Paul sat down with a pen and a piece of paper and came up with one of the most identifiable logos in the history of American business. It is up there with the McDonald's arches, the Nike swoosh. And it didn't take, you know, as I suppose now, if you and I said, so I don't know about the Apple logo. It seems relatively simple. I'm sure it cost somebody millions of dollars to create it and a million focus groups. And are we going to do this? They were by the seat of their pants. And by that second issue, the Playboy Bunny logo appeared, and it's appeared in every magazine since. And on clubs and on planes. And
the thing took off. And through the 60s and early 70s, it was this empire.
Yeah.
Airplanes and movies and clubs and casinos.
Yep.
Then what happened?
Well, the casino business went sort of bust in London under a guy named Vic Lowndes, who had been one of the early guys here. At Playboy's height, it was selling 8 million copies of that magazine every month. That's a lot. The clubs kept doing well, but then, you know, the world got more sophisticated. Penthouse magazine came out, and that cut a little into the whole circulation. Mores got a little looser, and certainly, you know, Hefner went to court dozens of times to fight for the First Amendment, the freedom of speech.
Well, you know, that's funny because I don't know why I'm such a fuddy-duddy about this subject, but I always have been. I mean, to me, there's two versions of Hugh Hefner. One is the First Amendment champion and this progressive social thinker.
Civil rights champion.
And then the other one is just kind of this creepy guy in silk pajamas who in his 70s has a 27-year-old girlfriend. And I think...
See, I think that...
I don't know how to reconcile those two.
Well, because his later year, had Hef died at, like, let's say 73, right after I interviewed him. He was so shocked by the nature of the interview that he just had a heart attack. Then he would be thought of a lot vastly different. I do think that in his later years, probably 70 on, he did seem like some kind of weird caricature, some kind of weird uncle. You know, the satin robe, the pajamas, the unbelievably young blonde, buxom women that
triplets
he hung
along for God's sake.
I know, but I also think, in his defense, and I can't tell you this for sure, but I'd bet a lot that he was in his way trying to still be the brand when he would, and this was in the 90s when people like Leonardo DiCaprio and the young hot crowd of actors were all admiring and idolizing him. I think it gave him, and I think he thought that that kind of idolization would help the magazine and help the empire.
Yeah.
So I can't blame him for being kind of, you know, it's like Willie Mays in the outfield, man. It's like, you know, do you really need to play Willie when you can't get that fly ball and fall down? Yeah, he needs to play.
It's 1:23. Our phone lines are ringing with people who have their Playboy magazine story. Do you have one? I'm going to pause here.
Well, it's not really a story. It's just a list of where I would steal the magazine.
Well, that's
a young teenager.
Steve Cochran had a story like that, too, I think, or at least he would read it in the drugstore tucked into a Life magazine. I have a story, too. We all do. But just tell me that little anecdote. It doesn't need to be life-shattering or changing, but 312-981-7200, you can text it to that number, too. Ellis handed me a sheet of some of your texts. A few years ago, when Hefner's little black book came out to talk about what Hugh Hefner meant to a lot of people.
What's your favorite Chicago memories? Give me two or three.
The last 2 years of high school were like a mini hint of what life might be like after Playboy. I think that I, quite literally, on a personal level, I started Playboy because of dreams put away, the dreams that that came from childhood and adolescence.
So it's kind of
the last 2 years of high school. A while back, a writer for National Geographic was doing a piece on Sunset Strip, and it interviewed me. And in the interview, he said that he had seen his first nude in Playboy magazine. I said, that's okay. I saw my very first nude in your magazine. When we were kids back then, National Geographic.
I guess you're right, now that we think about it.
Yeah, because you go to the library and you flip through.
You're a little funny back then. One of the problems with marriage in modern society is that we live too long. You know, in the old days, it was much easier, you know, to make a lifetime commitment if your lifetime was only about 40 years.
Bill Zemme, Steve Cochran, and Hugh Hefner here on WGN Radio, the full interview at WGNradio.com. I think men of a certain age have a Playboy magazine story.
No question. No question. I've heard about 80 of them today.
Got me more than you may want to hear.
Yeah.
I'm going to make you listen to a couple
of
others.
Just read them. I've read them. I haven't been answering the phone today, John.
Hey, Alan, you're on WGN Radio. Hi.
Hi, how you guys doing?
What's good on your mind, man?
So I was maybe 11 or 12 years old. My neighbor left a stack of Playboys out by the garbage.
That fool.
Yeah, that fool. I thought it was pretty cool, though, so I was okay with it. I took them, put them in the back bedroom in the closet, hid them back there. Of course, my mother eventually found them, which didn't make me happy, but she also immediately blamed me. And I have an older brother. I have a father. I'm like, hey, it wasn't me.
I'm only 11, Mom. I'm only 11.
God, that was
right
away,
funny.
Somehow, it was me.
I was probably 10 when we found our first stash, and you know, we were beyond belief excited. We had no idea what to do with these things.
Yeah,
we weren't even at. We knew what we were looking at, but we didn't know what to.
So you dipped right into the. You said, "Okay, let's find that Norman Mailer short story in here." Yeah,
we weren't fully formed sexual creatures,
right,
so
correct.
We knew that there was something going on here, but we really weren't sure what to do with it all. And we found him in the woods, and we were like, oh, my God, look at this. But we knew we couldn't bring it home, and we couldn't stay in the woods. So we tore some pictures out and stuck them to the trees and ran home and told our mom and dad. And
what a good boy you were.
What a ridiculous thing to do.
What a good boy.
It was a very confusing age. Alan, thanks for the call.
Sure, you bet. Nice talking to you guys.
Yeah,
thanks,
likewise.
Alan.
Don, you're on WGN. Hi.
Hi, I was early 60s, probably 13 or 14 years old, got my first babysitting job with three local boys, and of course I was a farm kid and pretty well sheltered, and while I'm babysitting these boys, one of them, the youngest one, probably 6 or 7 years old, says, "You want to see some boobies?" I went, huh?
Yeah.
And he ran to his parents' bedroom, came back with the very first Playboy. In fact, I didn't even know it existed. And so he whips it open, and I look at it, and I kind of nonchalant it. I said, hey, by the way, it's you guys, it's time to go to bed.
Yeah. I'm a good babysitter now. Don, thanks for the call. All our phone lines are filled with stories like that. Okay.
Everybody's got them. I mean, men of a certain age, certainly.
Let's just do one more here real quick. Hey, Mike, you're on WGN Radio. Jump in there, Mike. What did you want to say? Hey, Mike. Hey, Mike, is that you?
Hello.
Hey,
hello.
You're on the air.
I'm here. Okay.
He's still listening to his radio. We'll come back to Mike another time. Read Rick Hogan online, chicagotribune.com, and listen to him. When do we listen to you again here?
Sunday night. 9 to 11. Thank you, John. And go see John and his Minsky and Rascals and other GN folks at the podcast festival
October
coming up
this, 7th.
This week. Yeah, this week. Good luck there. It's fun.
Yeah, I know
it's
you've fun. Done this sort of thing before, and I appreciate that because I'm a little nervous about who the heck wants to come and watch me and Eric Zorn.
More people than you would imagine, John.
WGNradio.com/events. Kristen McQuarrie and Steve Bertrand, too. Thank you, sir. It's 143 on WGN Radio. By the way, on your business lunch show, what's the name of that thing you do between noon and 1 here at this radio
it's
station?
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Did you talk about, I was only half hearing it in the halls, I was in and out of a studio, about mortgage interest deductions and what's going to happen with either the new federal?
Yeah, we've talked quite a bit about it. The mortgage deduction, the interest deduction is safe.
Okay, good.
But the property tax write-off is not.
Oh.
Which is bigger. It might not be bigger for you. You just bought again.
Yeah.
But it is bigger for a lot of homeowners who've had their home for a while.
Okay, so wait a minute. Interest I pay on my loan, I'll still be able to deduct that, which
yes.
is huge.
And the charitable giving, you'll still be able to deduct.
But I'm able to also deduct my
property tax bills and what you pay in state income tax.
Okay, so I think I'm paying around $7,000 or $8,000. I mean, it's not a lot. In the suburbs, some of you would cry for $7,000 or $8,000, right?
Oh, I know people who pay $20,000.
I do too, and it's funny because even when I was living in LaGrange Park and we were paying a little bit more, a friend of mine was in, I think he was in LaGrange and some in Western Springs, and some of them had ones that were double mine. My sister lives in Will County, and I think hers is about double mine.
Right.
My house is more valuable than hers just because it's in Chicago. She's got, you know, more space, bigger house, all the bells and whistles. But
it's funny.
Property taxes are much higher.
People who, you know, we hear about the city people worried about their property taxes so much. I mean, it's hard for me to understand because it's not close to what a lot of people or most people pay in the suburbs, I think.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, though, but so the opponents say, well, look, this is double taxation because you're taxing what we're paying in taxes, right? Which is sort of like what in the estate tax opponents, and the estate tax would go away under this plan.
Yeah.
And the estate tax opponents had always argued, you're taxing this money twice. You're taxing it when grandpa made it, and now you're taxing it when I inherit it. And now they're arguing, they're ignoring that argument when it comes to the property tax deduction. You're taxing it when you make it, and then you're taxing it when you pay taxes on it.
Yeah, right. You know, I got an email from a listener here whose husband was at Jimmy John's. And he was supposed to pay the tax on a soda, right? So it's going to be, instead of 89 cents, it's going to be like $1.15 or something. And so then he looks, and they tax the whole bill, the additional, I mean, I don't know how they do that, because it's a penny an ounce.
So they put the tax on and then tax the tax?
Yes, they did.
Well, and that's not good.
That's not good. And I don't know how many of us have thought to sort of decipher the fine print at the end of your fast food bill.
That's not freaky fast. That's freaky sneaky.
So I haven't done that. And I, to be honest with you, I don't drink a lot of sweet beverages. I just drink alcohol. I'm not better than you. I just have a different vice.
I've seen other receipts where they put it on there. Sweetened beverage tax.
Yeah, I think they should. I think they should. I mean, I sure don't have a problem with that. But if that's their sort of passive-aggressive way of letting you know it's not our fault, it's this county's fault, more power to them. There's nothing wrong with us being educated as consumers about that. The president's tax proposal, I don't know that much about, and you don't either, except that everybody, it sounds to me like, is going to have to pay less in taxes. So I'm big thumbs up for the new president's tax plan.
I don't know if that's true, but
I think
ahead.
I think my federal income tax rate's going to go down about 10% or 8% or some percent. And the rich people are going to have theirs go down. And the middle class people are going to have theirs go down. And the poorest among us are, in effect, not going to have to pay tax. So no, I think that nobody will have to pay taxes anymore.
I don't
it's
think
the best
that,
plan ever.
Well, you want me to argue with you?
I don't care what you say.
Because they're, I know, I'm used to it. But from what I was reading, there are people whose tax rate might go down, right?
Yeah, right.
But losing these deductions
yeah.
would effectively raise their taxes. There is a donut in there somewhere.
Well, I know somebody.
I think they're described as the upper middle class.
Yeah, well, that might be me. And I know somebody's got to pay the freight. I mean, I'm being only a little silly here. Everybody's very attracted at lower tax rates. But then when you take away some of the deductions that we enjoy, which are called loopholes and not always fairly, for instance, the reason that we have some of those quote-unquote loopholes is to encourage social behavior like owning homes. If you think America is better if we all own our own homes, and a lot of us do, then how can we encourage or enable people to do that?
Charitable giving is another example.
Exactly, really. Why do we do that for charities? Are we for charities? I guess so. We think that's a good thing, but it's also something that, well, I guess that's really what it is. It's social engineering, and I don't necessarily have a problem with that. But the problem is that when they take some of those away, suddenly the lower tax rate isn't all that it's cranked up to be, is it? Because then you end up paying more in the long run.
Right. And so, and the other thing is with lowering the corporate tax rate, and there seems to be, you know, great support for that on both sides of the aisle, ideas that things need to be done. And that's great. I'm all for that if everyone pays the lower rate. But the fact is there are many businesses now that pay nothing in taxes because they're able to take advantage of the loopholes and the deductions and all of that, some of which are good when it comes to research, some of which are just, you know, candy to the lobbies, but we're making an assumption that the businesses are going to stop trying to get loopholes if we only reduce their taxes. That's not true. They're going to keep trying to get more loopholes.
I don't blame them.
Right?
No, I don't blame them.
That's what they're there. They're,
no, but you do
they're an entity designed, to, their job is to make money.
No, but I hope you agree with me that we do need to find a way to get some corporations to pay more in taxes. Some big corporations need to pay more in taxes. Do you agree with me on that? You remember hearing the General Electric didn't pay any stuff like that.
That's my point.
That's not a good thing.
So you can argue that, wow, it's 37%. That's the highest in the world. It's not good. Well, not if they're effectively paying zero.
That's right. I'm not. That number has never been so persuasive to me when I read that NBC or GE or somebody else isn't paying as much as I am, for crying out loud. I know what you're thinking. Hey, John, what does Mike Ditka have to say about NFL and the kneeling? So Snead had a pretty, this is classic Mike Ditka. I mean, really, just imagine how Ditka would respond to, hey, Ditka, what do you think of this kneeling controversy? Let me read you the line in a minute. Brendan and I went to that one 1 month ago or two. You know, they do it once a month, and I don't think it was the last one. It was the one before. Anyway, I was struck by this. As a guy who kind of was growing up in radio, I've always liked antique radios, even the sort of plasticky ones from the 50s to the wooden ones of the 40s and 30s. And there is a guy who has been there for years and years and years and years, and he has the same booth in the same place every time. And he sells beautiful, refinished, high-quality radios. And if you've got $49 or $349 and you want to spend money on a piece of art that's functional, and is showplace ready in your home, go to the Kane County Flea Market and buy from that guy. I mean, some people are selling tube socks in a plastic bag, and then there's this guy. That's the Kane County Flea Market. And I always linger in his booth. I've actually bought a radio from him. Right now I don't have space for a radio. But if that wets your whistle, that's the place to go. Financial planning is more than just getting you from point A to point B. Many firms are good with numbers, but the numbers only matter if they help you live a more enriched and fulfilling life. That's what we're trying to do here. And that's why at Private Vista, they take an evolved approach to financial planning that intersects those two. To the Private Vista team, financial planning isn't just about money. Whether you're recently divorced, trying to sell a business, maybe you're thinking about retirement, their team of trusted advisors will help you with some of these transitions. They care about the big picture in your life, realizing a clear view of how you want to invest your time, your energy, and your money. And then they help you get there. With offices in Chicago and Oak Brook, Private Vista will develop a plan to help you live out your definition of an enriched and fulfilling life. Go to myprivatevista.com. Set up a free consultation. Myprivatevista.com. Wealth management evolved. In today's Chicago Sun Crimes, Snead has an interview with the coach. I guess he was playing cards. I don't know how she found him on the phone, whatever. Mike Ditka, of course, is a big supporter of Donald Trump's, and so she asked the coach, what does he think about the players taking a knee? And here's the quote. Listen, I'm too old for this. Look, whoever you think is right is right. He could have stopped there because that's not a bad answer. I'm too old for this. You want it straight from the guy? Whoever's right is right. If you feel this way, that's your right. If you feel that way, that's your right. There's nobody. Why are we vilifying each other? He didn't say. He said this. Look, I'm too old for this. Look, whoever you think is right. But I don't believe you demonstrate against the American flag. I believe in the American flag. Or demonstrate against the Constitution. I believe in the Constitution. I'm old-fashioned. There are other ways to get your point across. But I don't believe one should demonstrate against our country. Just play football. And that's the way I feel. And now I'd like to go back to my card game. And so he did. And God bless you, Mike Ditka. But that is a complete misread of what everybody is or should be talking about. A lot of us are talking about it that way. But that is not the topic on the table. It would be like if you said to Mike Ditka, hey, what do you think of giraffes? And he'll go, giraffes? I don't like elephants. Elephants are bad. Why would you say anything about an elephant? You say, no, I asked you about giraffe. And now they're talking about elephants, and you cannot get them to talk about giraffes. That's what we're getting a lot of that these days. After the news, we're going to talk to Dr. John Cunningham. He is an expert in the treatment and research of childhood cancers and blood diseases at the University of Chicago. And there has been a major breakthrough on the I don't know if they're going to use the word cure, but he told me this morning that the fixed rate on this is 80% to 100%, where some children were absolutely going to die. Now they are almost absolutely certainly going to live with childhood cancers. And it's a fantastic story that comes right through Chicago.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
All right, you can text your big thoughts and little recollections to 312-981-7200. We'll pass those along as we work our way to the Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantis. That's at 3:20, almost 8 now on WGN. This is John. So I told you, tell me your Playboy magazine story. I think everybody has one of a certain age, and I'm not sure. I know the age goes to infinity. I'm not sure how young it gets, because if you're 20 years old, that magazine and those stories don't resonate with you the way it does for somebody who's 50 or 60 or 90. Hey, John, I came home from high school and all of the pinups were stuck to my wall. Thanks, Mom. Boy, was I embarrassed.
I'm busted.
I'm thinking this is exclusively a male conversation, but really the moms or wives probably have stories. How many moms who are, I don't know, now 70, remember getting their sons, finding it under the mattress, the Playboy magazine? I'm so disappointed in you, Tommy.
It's funny how the memories stay with you, right? I remember babysitting for a neighbor, too, when I was probably 9.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I'm sitting in the dad's recliner and reach down to the magazine. I'm like, oh, look at that.
Well, that's the thing. So I'm 57, and I'm reading these stories from other guys who are 57 or maybe a little younger, and a lot of them plenty older. And it sounds like they're 12 now, that these stories are fresh. Some of you still have your Playboy Club membership card or key. Like, that's going to get you somewhere right now. What's the point of that? John, I enjoyed finding for and looking for the bunny on every cover. Yeah, that was kind of a thing. John, my dad had
waste of time. Open it up.
Really, who are we kidding? John, my dad had a 1955 Chevy Bel Air two-tone green in the driveway, and it was filled to the top with newspapers. We used to tunnel around inside there, and I tunneled into the first issue of Playboy. I kept it in my room for a really long time until it was found by my mother and it disappeared. I think I was 11. Yeah. Yeah, that was the other thing, too. You didn't want to throw away a good Playboy magazine, but really, what were you going to do with it? How is that so exceptional that next month's wouldn't virtually replace what you had in January? And don't say the articles. Now, we'll keep reading through them as you send them in. 312-981-7200. This is an interesting story. I talked earlier today with a guy named Dr. John Cunningham. He's an expert in the treatment and research of childhood cancers over at the University of Chicago Medicine. And evidently, there has been some progress made on juvenile cancers that sure escaped me. But now I'm hearing about it. And you know how you don't want to get too hopeful when you hear about a breakthrough in cancer research? This one does make me very hopeful. Doctor, this is John Williams. You're on WGN. How are you?
Hi, John. Nice to be with you.
Tell us a little bit about this, because if it's juvenile or adolescent cancers, to me that would be a whole family of them. Are we speaking about a specific kind of cancer?
So at the moment, we're speaking about a specific kind of cancer. It's acute lymphoblastic leukemia, also called ALL, which is the commonest childhood and young adult cancer.
ALL.
ALL, yes.
I've heard of ALS. Is this related to that?
No, it's acute lymphoblastic leukemia. So ALS is a neurological disease.
Sure. Okay, so leukemia, I've heard of that. So what's happened here?
So what's happened is that although we cure many of these children and young adults at this stage, this is children and adults under 25, about 30% of patients don't respond to standard therapy, and they require quite exceptional means to either get them into remission or, unfortunately, they pass away from the disease. What the FDA licensed about 2-3 weeks ago was a new drug, which was only available in Chicago at the University of Chicago, where we actually take the patient's own T cells. These are blood cells that are usually used by the body to get rid of viruses or get rid of any foreign cells that come into the body. And if you think of cancer as a foreign cell, and so we take the cells out of the child or young adult's body through a simple procedure, blood cells, that is. We identify the T cells, and then we supercharge those T cells with a special virus that when the modified cells are put back into the child's body, they go to the acute lymphoblastic leukemia cells and literally kill them. And so it's a sort of a way of developing a natural killer yeah. cell for the child.
Who knew, though, that you think you would not want to introduce anything in your body to a virus? How did anybody think introducing a certain virus to the T cells will therefore make them better fight off leukemia?
Well, you know, some of the early work, and this is one of the reasons why we're very excited as scientists and physicians some basic science, some of which was done at the University of Chicago 20 years ago, was the starting off point in actually identifying this approach. And this is very important. This new treatment is very important for several reasons. One is it's the first gene therapy that's been licensed by the FDA for clinical use. And secondly, the results are truly exceptional. Like, I've been doing taking care of children with cancer for over 30 years, and this is the most remarkable therapy that we've seen in the last 30 years, with response rates of up to 80-85% in children and young adults who would, unfortunately, only 10% of them before this treatment was available would survive their disease. So it's a very exciting time, and it's a paradigm shift for cancer therapy. I think one of the things for those people who are thinking about other diseases, because lymphoblastic leukemia is not that common, is that both at the University of Chicago and elsewhere, we're using the same kind of approach now to treat other diseases.
Hmm. So, yeah, that's my next question. If this works for this kind of leukemia, would it work for other leukemia or other kinds of cancer?
So we very shortly will be introducing a treatment, a licensed treatment. We expect the FDA to license a similar treatment for a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which, as you probably know and your listeners know, is a very common lymphoma in cancer of the lymph glands in adults. And scientists here and at other universities and research institutes across the nation are now testing similar approaches for other diseases such as lung cancer, breast cancer, and neuroblastoma, which is a very serious solid tumor of children and childhood.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of opportunities in the next few years, and you're going to hear a lot more of these kind of therapies.
So it's not a drug, though. I mean, it's not a new drug you've developed, but rather you introduce a particular virus to the person's own T cells, put those same cells back in them, and then their own body is fighting the disease. Is that it?
Exactly. So what we're doing is we're taking some of the patient's own cells, and we're changing them slightly so that they really go and attack the tumor cells. So we're essentially not just supercharging them, but targeting them so that they will specifically go after the tumor. And that's one of the exciting pieces about it. It's a sort of precision medicine. One of the phrases that we're using for this now that you'll hear in the press is cellular immunotherapy, because we're using cells from the patient themselves, and we're using they're the immune cells, the defense cells for the body, but we're giving them sort of special powers or special activity that allows them to go and attack and kill the tumor cells in the child or young adult's body.
This is gene therapy. Is that a controversial topic, or am I thinking of something else?
I think you're thinking of something else. There have been controversies in the past about gene therapy with respect to whether the virus might that's part of it that might divide and infect other cells in the body, but this virus is so well constructed that it only stays in the cells we want it to stay in. And in fact, what usually happens is that the cells go, they attack the tumor, and then they essentially disappear. There's just a couple of them left in the body for long periods of time. And if the tumor was ever to reappear, this lymphoblastic leukemia was to reappear, then they would proliferate again or divide again and actually attack the tumor again.
Yeah, right. So you and I talked about this off the air this morning, but you put those cells in my supercharged cells back in my body. They're going to stay there. Will this sort of immunize me from the recurrence
exactly.
of the disease?
Exactly. That's a great way of describing it. Essentially, what is hoped is that 80% of the children who are treated for this disease with this treatment will be immunized long term and will be cured. And if you think about it again, less than 10% of the children who are who were eligible for this treatment would have survived without this treatment. So it's amazing.
Dr. John Cunningham's on the phone from the University of Chicago Medicine. We're talking obviously about this new cancer treatment that came through Chicago, and I know I've got a couple of listeners with questions about it. Marco had one. You're on WGN. Hey, Marco, what can we do for you?
Good afternoon, John. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Good afternoon, doctor. Thank you for gracing us with your presence. You're a very, very well-known man.
Thank you, Marco.
My question is, how often is the non-psychotropic properties of marijuana used in cancer research or the treatment of? Because my oncologist himself has affirmed multiple times that marijuana kills cancer. And I've seen multiple write-ups stating that the paste help cure seizures and things like this in children. But as a taboo topic, we're giving children marijuana, but it would be non-psychotropic. My question is that happening, that we can actually start implementing the chemicals we have found that are useful in marijuana? Not, like I said, not the psycho properties, but, and also, is the FDA putting a wall up? Because
Hold on, wait, one question at a time. Jump in there, doctor. What do you want to say so far?
So first of all, you know, the topic we've just been talking about is completely different from marijuana treatment in medicine. But essentially, the two major ways that that are licensed by the FDA to actually use marijuana at the moment are, one, some of the components of marijuana are used as an appetite stimulant for children and adults who are cancer survivors who have poor appetite. And secondly, we and others are using marijuana oils from the point of view of patients with intractable epilepsy. So those trials continue to go on. If I remember rightly, the FDA has still not licensed marijuana for epilepsy. It's still in its trial phases, but I'm not a neurologist, so I don't want to speak to whether it's licensed or not. But there are no convincing studies to show that marijuana has any role as a agent in the treatment of cancer, specifically killing cancer cells.
Killing cancer, but they do tell us that it helps in pain management.
Pain management and appetite stimulation are both things that are there, and they're very, very important. Don't get me wrong. I prescribe marijuana-like substances for children that I care for who've got appetite problems and have got pain problems as well. And my colleagues here at the University of Chicago Comer Children's Hospital have a trial for using marijuana oils in intractable epilepsy.
I'm glad to hear that. Thank you for the call, Marco. It is a tangent, but while we're there, I'll just say this. I have so little patience for people who, for some reason, are against any medicinal use of marijuana or its derivatives, because if somebody else is suffering and there's a hope that this will help them either manage it or get through it, who are you or I to take the moral high ground on that? I do not understand that. And legislatures across this country have been very slow to see it the way I see it, and I don't understand why, doctor.
Well, I'm not an expert on this area, but what I would say is that as a clinical investigator, I think the most important thing to do is, for any drug, whether it's marijuana or any other drug, is to test it in clinical trials to see if it's actually effective or not. I think that that's the most important thing.
Back to ALL. So this is the most, you said, am I right, common childhood cancer?
Yes, it's the most common cancer in childhood and in young adults as well.
And do you guys use the word cure if you're going from, say, 10% to 85%?
I think we're saying about 80%, but yes, cure is the phrase we're using, particularly for younger children. It appears to be a curative therapy. This agent was in clinical trials for about 4 years, both here and elsewhere. It started off at the University of Pennsylvania, and there is over 200 children who have now been treated with this treatment.
Well, that answers my question, because I'm wondering, are there? This isn't down the road. I mean, if some child is today diagnosed with ALL and the other modalities aren't successful, they can get this drug? Or this therapy?
Absolutely. They just need to. My information is on our website, and we'd be glad to speak to anybody who has a child with acute lymphoblastic leukemia who they think is eligible for the study.
And one last thing, then. Yeah, no kidding, the difference. And one last thing about that is how do people pay for this then? Is this something that insurance companies recognize as a valid treatment?
So it's such a new treatment that we continue to discuss this with the insurance companies, but we anticipate that the insurance companies will pay for this agent. And there are other mechanisms for those children who are not able to pay, or whose families are not able to pay for it. So I don't anticipate that any child will be, I can actually say categorically, no child will be denied treatment with this treatment. It's such an important treatment. Both our hospital and Novartis have agreed that we're going to make sure that every child, it's available for every child and young adult who needs it.
One of our texters wondered if you immunize your, if a child gets this, would they pass along that supercharged.
What a wonderful question. That's obviously a question we discuss with many families, and the answer is no, that the virus cannot move from one cell to another cell, and therefore there is no risk to either the child's ability to have children or for the child to pass this virus on to their children.
Would it be curative for their progeny, though? That is, they would
It won't be passed on, so no.
Yeah, okay. All right. Fascinating and really exciting stuff. I'll tell you what, it's good that there are some really smart people out there, because I wouldn't have come up with this, Doctor. This is fascinating and encouraging.
Yeah, we here are very, very excited about the opportunities that this provides for the children that are entrusted to our care. We think it's really going to be a very significant advance over the next few years in therapy for leukemia and hopefully for other diseases.
Can you imagine the parents of a child who thought, oh my God, we have no hope, and then this comes along in your lifetime? So, Dr. John Cunningham, University of Chicago Medicine, and you said there was a website. I'll ask you to give it to my producer off the air, and then maybe we can pass that along to our listeners as well.
We'd be glad to do that.
Okay. It's 223. This is WG. I said, text to me your Playboy magazine story. Hello, John. I was caught looking at my dad's Playboy magazine by my dad when he got home early one night. It was the Vanessa Williams issue. Thank you, Jesse. Hi, John. I grew up in Hinsdale. I'm now 66. The village used to allow homeowners to burn their trash in the alley. My brother and I found a partially burned Playboy in the trash. The Jane Mansfield issue, the mother lode, ! The magazine came to our campus in the early 1990s. Ball State. The amount of women who wanted to be in the magazine was crazy. Oh, I see. The magazine came to our campus. They were doing the women of Midwest campuses photo shoot. I'm a woman myself. I bought that issue. It was my first, and I seriously got hooked on the articles, and I've read it for years. Great interviews. John, the magazine degraded women. I don't care how artistic it was. It started a whole mindset in our culture where exploitation became more widespread. I was talking to Rick Hogan, who wrote the long and really well-done piece in the Chicago Tribune today about that. He started out our show. And I said, the person that I never really understood, that I got a little agitated at, was Christy Hefner. I mean, I know that's your dad and it's the family business, but how can you, as a woman in good conscience, be the CEO of Playboy Enterprises? She would. And Hogan said, I know her very well. I've known her for the years, and she's a feminist. I says, how can you be a feminist and be the CEO of Playboy magazine? He said, well, she's one of the women that feels that magazine did not exploit women. It empowered women.
I was going to say, you ever take your clothes off in public? It's very empowering.
There's the yin and yang of this sort of thing. I mean, I get it that if you're a woman and you take charge of your own sexuality, you're liberated, you can, I'm not exactly sure if this is the way that logic train goes, but you can use it any way you want for pleasure or for power, but you are in control. I guess I get that. But at the end of the day, you're asking women to take their clothes off for entertainment purposes. How is that empowering? Now, there's the pro and con. John, this is from another woman. I found my dad's Playboy stash in his bedside magazine rack. I was not embarrassed. I was just very curious. I looked at my 8-year-old self thinking, one day I'm going to have those too. Now, 50 years and 5 kids later, I need to pick them up off my stomach to get them in my bra, said this person. John, my brother posted a Playmate of the Month on his bedroom wall back in the 1960s. Mom did not get mad and rip it off the wall. Instead, she got out her scissors and a scrap of fabric to make a dress that she pinned over the nude. We all had a good laugh. And she said the poor girl looked cold. My brother took it down after a while. Boy, that's probably the most intelligent conversation.
That is great parenting there.
Well, that is good parenting. Because, you know, this is the thing. The interest that drove the 12-year-old boys to do that, I mean, the find was almost more titillating. The very pursuit of these things was more, exciting than sometimes the pictures that you saw. But it was all good. But I think it's also very natural. I mean, it's in the DNA of a 12-year-old boy.
It's not bad.
It's totally not. I've long felt that this country has completely had its vices confused, that we are okay with, on TV, showing really ridiculous, horrible, violent crimes as entertainment, and then the cops solve the mystery. But, oh, my God, you show a bare breast, and that's pornography. If you had to pick one, wouldn't you rather show people having sex or showing breasts as opposed to murdering each other for entertainment purposes?
I do every night when I choose my Netflix shows.
What do you mean by that?
Nothing. Yeah, right. I mean, I agree with you.
And here's another, I think, very common experience for the Playboy magazine set. John, 12-year-old girls babysitting in the mid-1970s. Found the Playboy stash and thought, wow, is that what we're going to look like? A little anxious about the various things that would happen to us over the years. But yeah, I suppose anybody who ever babysat probably found his stash somewhere. And then boys or girls were looking at him. Hugh Hefner passed away at the age of 91. This is WGN. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. I'm John Williams. Ro Khan and Anna DeVlantis ready to invade the studios in just a few minutes. If you know what I'm talking about, I swear to God I'm close. If I'm not right, I'm really close. Kevin just sallied up into the sports office upstairs, I see, but I'm not sure if he's dialed in on us right now. Are you listening right now, Kevin? No, I don't think he's. I think he's busy. It's the time between when a team wins the World Series and then makes the playoffs. That does not happen that often. So what the Cubs did last night was noteworthy. Period. End.
So I'm looking at a Sports Illustrated story, and it says, John Williams is incorrect when he says, recent history has been unkind to World Series winners. None has repeated as champion since the 1999 Yankees and again in 2000. So I think that's what you were thinking of.
Wait, repeated?
Repeated as World Series champion. That goes back to 99-2000.
But it was something the Cubs did last night.
Just 7 out of 16 made the playoffs at all.
7 out of 16.
Right.
Well, that's not nearly as dramatic as what I had. Well, I said it hasn't happened in 20 years.
Yeah, but you were just,
I was riffing.
Yeah, but it has been several. It's been like 4 years or something, which still is pretty significant that a World Series champion doesn't even make the playoffs.
Yeah. Maybe there was a certain truthiness to what I was saying, so that what I said was not true. It really was. It just wasn't accurate.
What did you say, John, again? I'm sorry.
Okay, here's what I'm trying to push here, Kevin. I know you're busy over there.
Kevin, try to imagine something. By the way, Kevin, I was watching Kevin on TV last night. Did you see
what was he doing on TV?
Champagne face in the locker room with the Cubs.
Oh, no kidding. How much fun was that?
It was great. It was flashbacks to last year. They're getting pretty good at this whole celebration thing, these Cubs.
Hey, Kevin, did you know this? That team wins the World Series. The next year, they make the playoffs. That has not happened for 16 years or 20 years or something.
I would not say that's accurate. I believe it was 2000, just about
12.
6, yeah, 12, right? Yeah, that's what I thought.
Elif just looked it up.
Yeah, I thought found it was like 5, then, 6, or 7, some years.
I don't recall, Elif. Would you remember what I said when this started?
You said that I was probably wrong.
No, I said it's been 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
2012.
It was the St. Louis Cardinals.
I knew it was the Cardinals. That's I said it was
yeah,
the Cardinals.
Yeah, you did say that.
In 2011, and then they lost in 2000. Or no, they won in 2011, and then went back.
And guess what? I found that on my own, and then a listener confirmed.
Confirmed it, huh? Mm-hmm.
All right. A little help from Google.
Thank
you, Elf. Yeah, either way.
Wait a minute, you're poo-pooing the fact that she used Google for that?
No, that's...
I'm happy that we were able to find it in any form or matter at all.
Regardless, it's extremely difficult, obviously, to repeat and just to get back. I mean, that's baseball for you.
So did you bring us any goggles or anything?
No, I went goggleless. I went rain jacketless.
Isn't that a little wimpy? You see that now. So that they don't get the alcohol and sparkling champagne in their eyes, they put it on goggles to have the celebration?
Yeah.
What, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? These are guys who stand in a batter's box and somebody throws a rock at them 100 miles an hour, and then when they celebrate with champagne, they put goggles on. I've never understood that. Not that they've been doing it forever.
I don't mind it because when they don't wear them and you're doing interviews and you see it on TV, all they're doing the whole time is wiping their eyes. They can't even concentrate on what you're asking them. They're just wiping the champagne.
Those
from
guys
their eyes.
Getting the rocks thrown at them are smart enough to wear a helmet, though, John.
That's true. Plus, I guarantee you it goes something like this. Up in the suites where the owners are, they go, okay, I'm paying Chris Bryant, actually, not a lot of money, but suppose you're paying these guys fortunes to win the World Series, and in the celebration, somebody's going to poke an eye out, right? It's like when they do the pile-on after a game or something. I'm like,
Well, that was when Mark Burley, when there was rain delays at Sox Park, and they put the tarp on,
he used
to turn it into a slip and slide. And after, you know, the fans loved it.
They did.
It was great. And then Jerry Reinsdorf stepped in and was like, let's not do that, because you can, you know, break a finger, do something weird. I mean, it's... You guys are getting paid millions.
Let's I got to pass
slip and sliding.
Two other things along here real quick. We're talking about Playboy magazine because Hugh Hefner passing away, and what was your Playboy magazine memory or story? John, my parents were pretty liberal with us. At 18, my mother actually got me my own subscription to Playboy. Unfortunately, my six-year-old brother found them and brought them to school for show and tell. John, Hugh Hefner is the only person who at his funeral, people will not say he's in a better place. Today, Steve, you mentioned this when we went from your show to mine. It's like National Baked Goods Day or something like that.
National Bakery Day.
National Bakery Day. So patronize a bakery. We got in front of that this week when we asked Paul Stokes to come by with one of those cakes from Angelica's Cakes. Hey, Paul, are you there?
Yes, sir. How you doing, John?
It's good to talk to you, my friend.
It's been a long time.
Here's what happened. So I bought that, what was it, the half sheet? Is that what you call it?
Yeah, the half sheet buttercream.
Buttercream cake with the white icing, with the football, the American flag, and the flowers. And then you brought by like a dozen of those caramel cupcakes, right?
Yes, sir.
Do you know how many of those caramel cupcakes I personally was able to get at?
I'm thinking you put some to the side for you and the Petersons.
That was my plan.
Paul, we went into the studio and took them because we knew that's the only way we'd get anything.
I had zero of them. And that big cake, so we put it upstairs, and I went away for a little bit, and I came back, and there was like maybe four bites left of the thing. I have never seen this staff sort of descend on a piece of cake faster or better than when they descended on yours.
Yeah.
It was a wonderful thing,
that's
sir.
That's good to hear.
Yeah.
That is good to hear.
Wasn't there caramel in that cake, the other cake, too, that you actually got a bite out of?
Last time, yeah. That caramel cake is amazing. I never understood the concept of caramel cake. It's a game changer.
Oh, yeah.
At angelicascakes.com. So keep up the good work. Things are going okay for you, Paul?
It is. Yeah. I appreciate you guys reaching out again.
I'm just telling you, I want to pat you on the back because it seems to me like anybody can make a white cake or a yellow cake and they can put flowers and white icing on it. I don't know what you guys are doing over there. I don't want to know what you're doing over there. Just keep doing
it. Yeah, the FBI, I don't want them knocking on my door, so let's just keep it.
That's right. Whatever your secrets are, keep them secret because that is a superior product, my friend. And if anybody's planning on a party or a tailgating thing or a football party or something, angelicascakes.com, get some of the caramel cupcakes, get yourself a big decorated sheet cake because it is the best. Nice to...
It is all because of the hard work of my mother, so I can't take any credit for it.
Keep up the good work, my friend. I'll talk to you later.
All right. Thanks, John.
Happy National Bakery Day or whatever. We had a doctor on a little while ago talking about research done on children's cancer, the most common kind of children's cancer. It's called ALL. It is a leukemia. They have developed a therapy that moves the cure rate for kids who would not have hope from 10% to 80%. It's an amazing story at the University of Chicago Medicine. The doctor did not have the website in front of him when he was talking to us about it. I have it in front of me now. I'll give it to you now and again after this quick break. If you go to uchicagomedicine.org/defeatcancer, You can find out more about that. You know somebody that's struggling with this topic? Here's a website to visit today. UChicagoMedicine.org/defeatcancer. Speaking of sports, and we have been a little bit, a text has just poured in from one Sam Panionovich, who will be on with us tomorrow. Kevin, he is picking the Packers tonight. He says, we are picking the Packers-7 tonight. Not exactly sure what that means.
It means they're a seven-point favorite.
Seven-point favorite.
So they would have to win by more than 7 points to cover that spread.
So he is saying that the Packers are not only going to win, but they're going to win by more than 7.
Correct. If they win by 7, it's, I guess they would call it a split or a wash or a draw or
a
whatever.
Push, yeah, something,
a
yeah.
Push, yeah.
Yeah. So Packers and by more than 7, says Sam. Do you concur with that, by the way?
Yeah, I think the Bears will have their shots. The Packers are beat up on that offensive line, and the Bears' front 7 is probably one of their strongest points on the team, but it's Aaron Rodgers. It's a Thursday night primetime game. The Bears always seem to struggle. They're on the road. It just feels like a game Aaron Rodgers could go off in.
Be interested in seeing what they do before the game. Are you interested in that?
I heard you talking about it a little bit earlier, John, and I think that the conversation is completely misled right now at this point, whether you should kneel or not. That's not the argument.
Yeah.
That's not the argument here. It's a much larger picture, much larger conversation, and it's basically just turned into should they kneel or not, and that is not at all
what the
conversation should be about.
So did you see Snead and talking to Ditka today?
I heard you. I heard you. Which is basically what I expected Ditka to say.
I know. He's just like, I got time for this.
Right.
Do whatever you want. Whatever you do is right. But you're wrong if you don't do the what. Dude, in fact, read what Ditka told Snead. That is exactly why we all need to stop talking about this right now.
Yeah. And did I hear Bertrand and you saying that day? CBS or Fox actually promoting the national anthem in their ads?
That's what Steve said, yeah.
So,
yeah, some countdown to their promoting the national anthem, which is,
it's wild.
That tells you something,
yeah.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
Taking care of yourself or your family is never an easy task. Riverside Healthcare can sure help with a variety of primary and specialty care providers. Riverside has just the right help for you, the kids, the whole family, over a dozen locations. They got that new campus in Frankfort. Boy, that makes getting the right care at the right place and time easy. Find out more about the nationally recognized Riverside Healthcare at riversidehealthcare.org. Riverside Healthcare, putting well within reach. One other medical note, I said I'd repeat that website for the University of Chicago Medicine, UChicagoMedicine.org/defeatcancer. A buddy of mine does radio in Peoria. Greg Batten, Dan DiOrio, worked with both of them for years. They've too been talking about this kneel or not kneel, and I think they're as fatigued of it as you and I are. Greg sent me this note yesterday. It said, so Sunday, I was at church. I knelt before entering the pew, and the guy behind me started to boo. It's pretty funny, Greg. The Ro Khan show on the radio now and again. And I'm always amused by Kevin and Violetta's sort of back and forth with you, Ro.
Yeah.
And sometimes I sympathize with you because I think you got your hands full there.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I know
with
I
us?
Do.
And
yes.
So Violetta is telling me off the air, because we were talking about cakes, that she does not like cakes with icing because she likes the icing better than the cake.
No, I like the cake better than the icing.
Oh, yeah,
keep
pardon
up.
Me. Everybody likes
see, John,
this
see
exactly,
what you just done right
I know, now. I know. And I'm like,
you know, because I've spoiled them. I think that's why. I think, you know, like every parent,
it's your
when
fault.
They stop
it's
and
your
they think,
fault.
When things go wrong, goes, I spared the rod, didn't I? that's the thing.
And I'm having this ridiculous conversation, I don't know what it was, with Violetta going, no, the cake is there to hold the icing. That's why we love cake, because of the icing. She doesn't want the icing on the cake.
It overpowers it.
It's a saying, the icing on the cake. That's what people love, right?
She's shockingly, I hate to say, no, well, yeah, yes, but that's not what I was going to say. She is shockingly down to earth for somebody who appears not to be,
yeah,
for her,
right,
whose head is in the clouds all
yeah,
the time.
Yeah.
She's sort of down to earth. I think the simpler things, even though she seems to be striving for the finer things in life, the simpler things in life very much excite her.
I also want to offer this, though, because I know you guys describe it that way sometimes, but every now and then while you are all going at it, she says something that I think cuts through the clutter perfectly. That I sometimes think like she's like this savant who says things sometimes on your show that I go, exactly. Exactly.
Thank you. Amen.
Yeah, do not encourage this because you're hearing the 1 out of 10 that actually hits and then the other 9 that are like, oh no, did she just say
that? Hit the button.
There was one yesterday. We were just trying to figure it out. I was just with management yesterday talking about the show.
What the hell is she talking about? Don't talk about
me with management.
And there was a moment where they go, didn't she say something about Ruth Bader Ginsburg yesterday? I go, I don't remember, but I just know that we moved on quickly.
So. I thought it was accurate.
Yeah. So
what are you doing on your fine program?
We have a lot going on today. We got Tom Skillington joining us right at the top. Tell us about the weekend. Peter Roskam is going to talk to us about this tax reform concept that's coming up all in the 3 o'clock hour.
I believe everybody's taxes are going down. Am I right about that?
Yeah. Okay.
Everybody.
Yeah. And Mike Rogers is going to be with us. He's got that Declassified show on CNN, which is amazing. But also the Russia investigation, what's happening there. Sweet Lou Canellis joins us from Fox 32. He's our Bears expert, and he is going to, and Adam Hogue, who is really our Bears. He's our in-house Bears expert.
He's on it.
Are going to both join us to talk about tonight's game. And then Richard Roper is going to join us in the 5 o'clock hour after the top five. And he has a long and storied history with Hugh Hefner.
Really?
And we will talk about that, and we have a little bit of an interview that Richard and I did with Hugh Hefner from, I think, 7 years ago.
Hmm.
And there's a couple interesting moments in that, so we'll play that. Because Hugh Hefner, I love him or hate him or think it's creepy or think it's groundbreaking. He was an icon that put Chicago on the map for a different reason than Chicago had been on the map.
No and stacker of weed him, no. He was the playboy.
He was the guy that changed, American pop culture, and it started in the Gold Coast of Chicago.
Really?
When you stop and you think about it.
Yeah.
And so he has a very important place in the history of the city. And then he took the whole thing out to Hollywood. I mean, it is an amazing, amazing, amazing story. And they kept the corporate headquarters here for as long as they possibly could to make it relevant in the print industry. And it's something. So that's all coming your way.
Have a good show, Rob.